Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we're going to open this morning with an orientation to some of the newest state-of-the-art developments in cancer care with an oncologist from the Griffin Center for Cancer Care in Derby. Then we'll invite you to support their good work at the 9th Annual Center for Cancer Care 5K Walk and Run coming up on September 30th. Then it's time to check in with the Connecticut Coalition to Regulate Marijuana following a press conference they held earlier this week highlighting several state municipal leaders who would prefer to see Connecticut legalize and tax marijuana for adult recreational use sooner rather than later. Then we'll close the show talking with several folks coming together around a first-of-its-kind health fair for individuals with disabilities and their loved ones and caregivers. We'll talk with the staff and a resident from New Horizons Village who are working with Cigna's leadership on this upcoming wellness festival. And we'll also hear from our friends at the Gaylord Sports Association about their role in the event, showcasing the many accessible sports activities that they support. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. Abilis, a nonprofit organization providing services and supporting 700 plus individuals of all ages with special needs and their families throughout Fairfield and Westchester counties, is holding its annual Walk and Run for Abilis. This event is being held at the Greenwich Point Park in Old Greenwich and will be held on Sunday, October 15th. Individuals, groups, families, runners, and walkers of all ages are welcome, and registration is open now. If you'd like to find out more, go to Abilis. That's abilis.us/walk.
Well, we are guests here at Griffin Hospital in Derby, Connecticut, to talk about some really exciting things that are happening here at the Center for Cancer Care at Griffin Hospital. We're very pleased to be with Dr. Joseph Cardinale, who's the Chief of Radiation Oncology at the Center for Cancer Care. He's been in the practice since 1984 and is certified by the American Board of Radiology in Therapeutic Radiology. We're also pleased to welcome back Lori Murphy. She's the Director of Radiation Oncology here at the center and founded the 5K Walk and Run with her colleague Laura Murphy. We're pleased to invite you to participate in the 9th Annual Center for Cancer Care 5K Walk and Run. It's coming up on Saturday, September 30th. Registration opens at 7:30, and we'll hear a lot more about that exciting event from Lori in just a few minutes. But we first want to take an opportunity to talk with Dr. Cardinale. There's some really exciting things that are going on here, Doctor, but I wanted to do a little bit of a look back since our visit with one of your colleagues a couple of years ago. You work really hard here at the center to be very innovative and state-of-the-art, but from a larger national global perspective, tell us a few of the things that you're seeing either recently implemented or on the horizon as an oncologist that, excite you and gives you a lot of hope as folks in your industry and across the realm of medical colleagues search for a cure for cancer.
Sure. Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak. And really the thing that's important in taking care of any patient with cancer is what we call targeted therapies these days. And that's happening across the board, whereas in medical oncology, where people are treated with a variety of different drugs, those drugs are now very targeted. And the purpose of doing that is it makes the side effects a lot less and makes them more effective. And in radiation therapy, we're able to do similar targeting very, very precisely. This is something we've been doing for decades, really, and it's just getting more and more precise. And so just recently, we've been able to acquire the equipment that enables us to do a type of procedure called radiosurgery. Radiosurgery is not a surgical procedure, but it's really the radiation equivalent of surgery, but an ultra-precise surgery where we could treat to within millimeter or even sometimes submillimeter accuracy to a variety of tumors in the brain, lung, prostate, spine. There's a whole variety of areas that can be done.
So let's that is the stereotactic radiosurgery?
Yes.
That we're talking about?
Yes.
So For the purpose of illustrating to the listeners, let's talk about how you can use that particular type of therapy to target the cancer and what side effects maybe used to be without SRS.
SRS. Yeah. Well, when you look at brain radiosurgery, the alternatives prior to this technology was either to do whole brain radiation to an individual or to put that person through surgery, brain surgery. And obviously there's risks to any kind of brain surgery. That's improved a lot, but there's risks with that, and some of those risks can be significant. When we did whole brain radiation, most patients, in all honesty, didn't survive very long because their disease progressed. However, when patients did survive long enough, it was fairly common for us to see significant short-term memory loss. And that was the biggest thing that we were very concerned about. And now that we have the ability to target the tumors themselves, the problems with short-term memory loss have really diminished very, very significantly, and people can go on and live a normal life. And the good thing about it is with these treatments, the control rate is the same as removing the tumor. And so a person can undergo this treatment frequently. It's a single treatment, very simple to do without a surgical procedure, and have the same control rate as undergoing surgery.
Is that an inpatient or outpatient?
This is all done as an outpatient.
Wow.
And it's very simple. Usually it would just take a couple of hours, really, of patient's time. The treatment itself only takes less than 5 minutes.
And keeping in mind there's very few other probably oncologists listening at early on a Sunday morning to the program, how do you explain from a nuts and bolts or an application procedure how this kind of therapy is delivered?
Usually the most important part of this therapy now is really the planning process. And so we do this all, say, for a brain lesion. We would do this based on MRI imaging. And so we would get a diagnostic MRI. We would then perform a procedure called simulation, which is a CAT scan, basically, that's done in our department. And then our computer systems, which are very, very sophisticated, can merge those two images and make them exactly one image. And we can look at any percentage of each image that we would like. And then we go through a very, very complex planning process with our treatment planning computer systems. Once that's completed and everything is approved and all the quality assurance is done, then the person is brought into the treatment room. The probably the most difficult part of it is something called the thermoplastic mask. We actually make a mask for the individual that adapts to their shape. It's made out of a plastic material that's soft. Doesn't hurt at all, but we try to keep the person in the same position. Once that mask is placed on the person, the treatment is delivered usually less than 3 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And it's very, very simple. Nothing touches, nothing hurts. And then after that, the mask is removed and the person goes home.
Well, being the proud owner of a thermoplastic mask myself,
oh, no.
I can assure folks who are listening that, it was more like feeling like you were on some Hollywood horror movie for those few minutes. But nonetheless, interesting, not too scary. The reason we're talking about this, folks, is because along with the stereotactic radiosurgery, this upcoming 9th Annual Center for Cancer Care 5K Walk and Run will benefit this and other new technology and work that's being done here at the center, including something called surface imaging.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, what surface imaging is, projecting a grid pattern on the patient's chest usually. And then there's cameras that are permanently mounted in the room that can look at the excursion of the chest. And what we know is that as the chest goes up, tumors in the lung, pancreas, liver will move with respiration. And they'll move in a very, very specific way. And so we can scan them in the simulator with that CAT scan using surface imaging technology and then correlate the position of the chest to where the tumor actually is located. So it enables us to do several things. One is we can target the tumor as it's moving, and make sure that we're treating it to just the tumor so that it doesn't move out of the area that we're treating. And by doing that, we can give very high doses and, again, eliminate surgery from an individual rather than having to have to undergo lung surgery. Mm. We could do that type of treatment. The other real benefit of surface imaging is in women with breast cancer. We know that when women breathe, obviously the breast is going to move. But what happens is when a woman takes a deep breath, the breast is further away from the heart. And our goal is not to treat the heart. So we can do something called deep inspiration breath hold. And the equipment is manufactured with a type of goggle system that mm-hmm. we put on the individual being treated. And they can see where their breathing pattern is. It creates mm-hmm. a graph. And so we'll ask them to take a deep breath, and they can see them holding their breath and
visually.
And so then they can hold their breath, and both they can see how they're holding their breath, plus we can do that also. And they get treated with the breast being pulled away from the mm-hmm. heart and really eliminate dose to the heart mm-hmm. altogether.
So that really puts the patient kind of in the co-pilot seat in the treatment.
Yes, it absolutely does. It gives the patient some control over their treatment and a participatory in it.
And as with the SRS, what were alternatives available to the patients prior to Griffin acquiring this technology?
Well, you know, the alternatives really were that the heart was going to get dosed. Mm. And some patients that did get treated like that would develop later on, years later, potential risk for heart disease as a result of the treatment. And so anything we can do to eliminate long-term complications, we certainly want to do.
And now we'll turn the microphone over to Lori Murphy. She is the Director of Radiation Oncology at the Center for Cancer Care here at Griffin Hospital. So let's look back. This race has, from its inception, has been pretty successful, very boutique, kind of local-centric, although you've drawn runners from all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
And it has kind of worked to find its right place between spring and fall.
Yeah, definitely. The fall, really, we chose the fall initially because we opened the cancer center in October of 2008. So during the course of the first year here at the cancer center, you know, myself, Laura, and a lot of the other staff here sort of got together and just decided, you know, we saw a need financially that needed to happen here mm. to support patients
sure.
for many, many things.
Right.
And we also wanted to do something that celebrated the anniversary of the opening of the cancer center. So that's where the fall date mm-hmm. came from. Yep.
And then for logistical purposes, it moved to the spring, then took a year off, and now it's back, kind of?
Yeah, so it's been in the spring for a couple of years. The initial sort of thought was aligning it with Cancer Survivor Month,
right,
which
right,
is
right.
in June,
yeah,
and
yeah.
and which worked out well. I think, you know, people liked the different time of year to participate. Logistically, it just sort of created a lot more pressure on the system here because mm. we had a lot of events going on
yeah.
at the same time for survivorship. So last year, we sort of decided, you know, we thought it might be best served if we moved it back to the fall. And actually, we've gotten a lot of positive response from yeah. folks that participate. I think it's a nicer time of year to also run.
Yeah.
And we're bringing back the long sleeve t-shirt, which is a wow. big, huge draw for people. They like the long sleeve t-shirts.
Yeah, and maybe yep. by September 30th, we'll start seeing the turn of what's supposed to be a really
exactly.
spectacular fall. So,
exactly.
So in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Lori, aside from this incredible technology, the stereotactic radiosurgery and the surface imaging and the deep inspiration breath hold technology, you said beneficiaries of this race could really number hundreds, not dozens. What are some of the other ways that money raised from this walk and run are benefiting folks throughout your service area?
And I think it's also important to note, too, that, you know, there's a lot of great fundraisers that go mm. on for cancer-focused.
Sure.
This fund is 100% of the monies raised stays in the cancer center, and it goes towards the patients and their families. None of the money is distributed anywhere else. This is the second time that we actually decided to use some of the funds to also help offset some of the costs for technology. So we definitely think it's important. Some of the other things that we do with the fund, there's ride services, there's the WIG program, there's medication costs, there's co-pays, there's just basic living needs that patients need help with from time to time. We helped a family that lost their home in a fire while the patient was undergoing cancer, helped families at Christmas time buy gifts for their children. There's so many things that the fund is used for. It's almost too many to count.
Yeah.
So it's really important that we keep driving the amount of money we raise every year.
Yeah. Well, as I was talking to Christian Nigger, who keeps arranging these interviews so effectively from Griffin, it's really cool that, you know, when you think of having been through radiation treatments myself, that shuttling back and forth, depending on the distance, can become quite costly. It's really cool that part, a fractional part of these funds could end up purchasing gas cards so people can make sure they make their treatments, because there are folks who are in a financial situation where they might just have to not go to a treatment because they can't put gas in their car.
Yeah, we have that actually very frequently. And some people don't have rides. They don't have – they're on their own. They don't have anybody to drive them, and they're not in physical shape to be able to drive. So we also offer, you know, the ability to pay for transportation. Yep.
Excellent. Folks, if something you heard during this segment inspires you, we hope you'll come down to this nice early fall activity, the 9th Annual Center for Cancer Care 5K Walk and Run. It's happening Saturday, September 30th. Registration opens at 7:30, and the event starts at 9. It's all happening at the beautiful Center for Cancer Care here at Griffin Hospital, just off Route 8 on Seymour Avenue in Derby, just across the street from the Griffin Hospital. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to griffinhealth.org/5K or check them out on Facebook at griffinhospital.walkrun. If you're interested, you can also call 203-732-7466. But for most of the information that you'll need to get involved, it's griffinhealth.org/5K. We want to thank our guests this morning, Lori Murphy, who is the Director of Radiation Oncology at the Center for Cancer Care at Griffin Hospital, as well as Dr. Joseph Cardinale, who is the Chief of Radiation Oncology here at the center. We hope we'll see you guys at the run coming up on September 30th. Well, I received some outreach just a couple of days before we're taping this, and I guess it bears saying that we're going to be talking with our guest this morning, Sam Tracy. He's the director of the Connecticut Coalition to Regulate Marijuana. He reached out to me ahead of a press conference that the organization held on Tuesday of this week. We're taping on Thursday, and by the time this airs on Sunday, it is quite possible, or maybe possible, that legislators in Hartford will have a complete budget package ready to go to the governor for a signature that will not include anything having to do with legalization of recreational marijuana. But there are still a lot of facts around this issue, at least from the perspective of Sam and the coalition, that really need to kind of get out there. So, Sam, I thought, as we said before we went on the air this morning, maybe this was going to be the year that Connecticut did end up going with some sort of provisional recreational legalization. Certainly, there appears to be a driving financial or economic reason behind it that is already succeeding in filling the coffers on behalf of taxpayers in many other states in the country. So tell us a little bit about the press conference and what's come from that in these 48 hours since we learned about it.
Absolutely. And yeah, thank you very much for having me on today. And our press conference this past Tuesday was focused on municipal leaders who are in favor of regulating marijuana like alcohol as part of a responsible solution to our state budget crisis. As people who have been following the budget debate surely know, while it is, of course, the state budget, it's not just a state issue. Because the state provides so much funding to municipalities, they're involved in this as well. So we had two speakers who were a current mayor, the mayor of Middletown, Dan Drew, and the former mayor, Jim Myron, of Stratford, who are both there to speak about why they thought it was the right thing to do, both for the state and for the 169 cities and towns in Connecticut. We've already got Massachusetts, our bordering state to the north, is going to be beginning recreational marijuana sales to anyone over 21, including Connecticut residents, next July. And there, it's a 17% state tax and a 3% local tax. So if we had something similar in Connecticut, where there was a local option, then that would give our cities and towns another revenue option to help diversify the revenue sources so that they could be pulling some money from the marijuana sales and help avert things like property tax increases or increasing the mill rate for auto taxes.
So we are also hearing for a while that after the Massachusetts vote and also the Maine vote, that Rhode Island was actually eyeballing fast-tracking some sort of legalization measure for recreational use. Where does Rhode Island stand as we speak, if you know?
Yeah, so Rhode Island did get pretty close this year, but unfortunately they concluded their session without having passed anything. But we are still hoping to see progress in Rhode Island probably next year as well. And also, just speaking of New England more broadly, Vermont has also gotten incredibly close. They're actually the only state where marijuana legalization has passed one of the chambers in their legislature. So they had previously passed it through their Senate. Unfortunately, the House didn't pass it, but we have gotten very close there, and I expect that they will be passing their own version of marijuana regulation next spring.
So we've got Massachusetts, imminent, ready to launch in within the next 6 or 8 months. What does it mean to a neighboring state that's eyeing the potential of legalization for recreational use for adults when a neighboring state sort of beats them to the line and legalizes first? Is there that sort of border proximity draw of customer base that can actually in the long term sort of sap money taxation for the legalized marijuana away from the state that follows?
Absolutely. And that's the thing. Connecticut is letting Massachusetts and Maine to a lesser extent, since it's, of course, a further drive. But those two states are getting a first mover advantage here in New England. And in Connecticut, it reminds me so much of the debate we had years ago over the Sunday sales of alcohol. People on Sunday, it's not that people wouldn't buy alcohol. It's that they drive to Massachusetts or Rhode Island or New York to do so. And while they're there, they probably filled up their gas tank and maybe went out to eat and did some grocery shopping. So it isn't just the marijuana revenue or the alcohol revenue that we're missing out on. It's also revenue from the rest of their shopping trip,
which may be fractional to the total expenditure, but still they fill up the tank of gas. There's gas tax to the other state. They go out to eat. There's restaurant tax, sales tax, and income to an employee of a location in another state. So it makes sense.
Exactly, and that's the biggest part to me, to be honest. The tax revenue is incredibly important. We could raise, according to the Senate Democrats, at least $180 million per year. I think that's a conservative estimate. But more importantly, if Colorado's any guide, we could create nearly 20,000 jobs in Connecticut by simply regulating marijuana. And so people, even under prohibition, are still very able to purchase marijuana. People do it every day in Connecticut. But the reality is going to be that next year, everyone's going to be within a short drive of a legal marijuana store. And so if everyone's able to buy it already, we're just giving all of that job creation and all of that tax revenue to Massachusetts. So we're essentially getting any negative effect of people having access, which I don't think is a negative, but opponents do. But then we're not reaping any of the positives in terms of job creation, tax revenue, or being able to regulate it the way that we want to.
And it was well over 2 years ago that Quinnipiac polled Connecticut residents, and more than two thirds of them came out, supporting at least making possession of small amounts of marijuana legal for adults.
So it appears there is the public sentiment. That poll was, March 2015. Is there a sense now that the willingness to at least pilot a legalized recreational marijuana initiative for adults has lost some of its momentum?
I don't think so. I mean, if you look at national polling, the amount of support for marijuana legalization has only increased in the past 2 years, as people have seen that the sky hasn't fallen in Colorado and Washington and Alaska and Oregon and the four additional states that are in the process of implementing their laws. And if you actually look at Washington state, since legalization passed, it passed with around 55% of the vote, but now support for their law is about 70%. So a lot of people who voted against it have seen this and seen, oh, this is actually working out a lot better than I thought it would be. So I do really think that if we had another statewide poll of Connecticut, those numbers would be much higher this year.
And so we're talking about potential loss of tax revenue and other revenue to neighboring states who may beat us to the punch or who have already. We're talking about creation of thousands and thousands of jobs here in Connecticut, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in added tax revenue. And in the last minute or so that we have with you, Sam, the issue of the cost of judicial processing and incarceration of individuals for marijuana-related crimes, small level, maybe repeat offenders, but there is another revenue draw to state taxpayers if marijuana for adult use is not legalized.
Yeah, exactly. So prohibition does cost taxpayers a lot of money already, and while we do have medical marijuana and we decriminalize marijuana here in Connecticut, that's really not enough. It is still an arrestable offense to have over marijuana. Most states is actually a higher threshold than we have. And I think most importantly, it's still a felony to grow any number of plants, even if you're a medical marijuana patient, which is unusual for medical marijuana states. So we've had patients here in Connecticut who've had their homes raided by police because they couldn't afford their medicine in a dispensary, so they were trying to grow a few plants at home.
Right.
So we want to both have commercial sales in stores, but we do also want people, like we have in 8 other states now, the ability to be able to grow a small number of plants in your own home, just like you'd be able to brew beer or something like that.
Yes, good information. Sam Tracy is director of the Connecticut Coalition to Regulate Marijuana, citizens, organizations, and community leaders working to end marijuana prohibition in Connecticut and replace it with a system in which marijuana is regulated and taxed similarly to alcohol. If you'd like to learn more, you can go to regulatect.org and see if there are some interesting points that you could learn beyond our brief conversation with Sam this morning. Sam, we did learn a lot. Thanks so much for taking some time. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Vauquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. As the weather gets cooler, the Simsbury Chamber of Commerce is heating up with its third annual Simsbury Spooktacular Chili Challenge. It's coming up on my birthday, Saturday, October 28th, with many new exciting additions, including a touch-a-truck area for kids of all ages, a classic car exhibit, a youth chili cooking competition for ages 17 and under, and the ever-popular Restaurant Chili Challenge. There'll also be fantastic musical entertainment all day from a couple of great regional bands. To get the schedule and any information you might need on registering for competitions, all you need to know is SimsburyChili.com. Well, as we begin to push the award-winning For the People out throughout the state of Connecticut, it's been a great, great pleasure and opportunity to get out more into the greater Hartford and northern and eastern Connecticut communities to meet some fantastic people with great organizations. And one of them that I have come to know over the past few months is New Horizons Village. They are working with Cigna's leadership development team to hold a wellness festival for individuals with physical disabilities and their families. That's coming up on Saturday, October 7th in Unionville, Connecticut from 11 to 3. The event is completely free and open to the public, and we're very, very pleased to welcome a huge team of guests to the program this morning, including a resident of New Horizons Village, who's going to talk about the challenges that she's had with her disability and why this festival is going to play such an important role for her and people like her. Carol Fitzgerald will be coming on the line shortly to tell us more details about the event. She's the CFO for New Horizons Village. And right now, please let me introduce you to Bob Marr. He's executive director. We're also going to be bringing on a guest representing one of the many vendors who's going to be represented from our friends right down the road at Gaylord Rehabilitation Hospital, who have been regular guests on the award-winning For the People for so many years. So a great team representing New Horizons Village, starting out with the boss, Bob Marr. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, John.
So give us the backstory on New Horizons Village. Of course, you've gone over it with me, but you guys got a great thing going out there.
Right. Well, early on, it actually began in the 50s and 60s. A number of physically disabled people wanted to leave the institutional setting of where they lived and wanted to seek an independent life and basically engineer their own life. They conceived of the idea of a New Horizons Village where they could live and pursue their independence and enjoy life the way they wanted to do it without feeling institutionalized. So related to that, you know, the organization was founded, and the overall organization is a nonprofit, a 501c3. And the official title of the organization is New Horizons, Inc. Now, New Horizons, Inc. was originally driven, as I said, by New Horizons Village. And the village itself, the physical community, it's 27 acres with basically 100 residents. And it was founded itself in 1986. But I just briefly want to go over the other components of New Horizons, Inc., and then I'll come back to the village. New Horizons, Inc. in 1994, opened up a Cherry Brook Nursing Care Center in a nearby town of Canton, and basically to serve two purposes. One is to serve the physically disabled who maybe would be better served by a nursing home setting than in the independent setting of New Horizons.
Skilled. They require skilled care.
Yes, they require skilled care. So it was looked upon as, you know, an advancement of the mission of the village.
Well, certainly I have to imagine it helped you not only accommodate formerly independent village residents whose conditions may have advanced, but also a much greater component of people in the region who needed that extra bit of TLC.
Exactly, because at Cherry Brook, we also coincidentally have 100 residents, patients, and right, it serves the Canton and surrounding communities there. We also then, about a year or two later, opened a very small facility in the town of Middlebury. We call it New Horizons Middlebury, and that basically services five physically disabled and or elderly people, also where they have a large sense of independence. So that entire piece, those three functions, are components of New Horizons, Inc. Now, about the village itself, as I said, it opened in 1986, and it's entirely comprised of people who are physically disabled. That is the driving criteria for living here. And currently, with a capacity of 100, we have 97 residents, and we have some applicants on the waiting list. And basically, what has happened here, what is very special about New Horizons Village compared to other alternatives, are two things. One, we have a village care department. And let me just, before I go into that, let me just say something in general about the physically disabled. The physically disabled will need care in the activities of daily living. If someone were to live in a place other than New Horizons Village, they would hire what we call personal care attendants, PCAs. Mm-hmm. And it's possible if they lived in town in an apartment building, if the PCA didn't show up, they now are having a struggle for themselves.
Right.
But what we have at New Horizons Village, the people basically do hire their PCAs, but to back that up, we have on staff what we call our VCA department, our Village Care Attendant department. And basically that is 24/7 coverage. So if a resident or tenant had a need in between the time when the PCA was supposed to come up, or or PCA, for instance, couldn't make it, we have backup. So it lends itself for our residents having tremendous security that they'll always be taken care of.
That sounds great.
And the other piece that is great about the village is we have our own transportation department. We have 7 to 8 vans and basically take people typically within about a 15 to 20 mile radius, but it also helps. We have special events and outings that the people go to, so the vans give them a sense, again, promoting that independence, that not only do they have this beautiful 27-acre campus here, but they are definitely connected with the outside world. And it's not only events, it could be shopping, it could be church, et cetera, like that. So those are the two distinguishing characteristics, and we find that it develops community. I mean, we're a normal group of people where you have people who are super easy to get along with and others who aren't. Mm-hmm. But in general, it's a tight sense of community.
Good.
And we have people from the ages of, can be from 18 to 80s plus.
Great.
So it isn't a age-driven piece. It's a physically disabled-driven criteria.
Great. Well, thanks, Bob Marr, for that great orientation. And speaking of special events and activities, folks, if you're just tuning in, this organization, New Horizons Village, is working with Cigna's leadership development team on a wellness festival, which is for individuals with physical disabilities and their families. It's absolutely free, and it's coming up in Unionville, Connecticut on Saturday, October 7th from 11 to 3. So we're going to hand the phone to Carol Fitzgerald, who's the CFO for New Horizons, who is sort of the event manager and the event specialists, to give us a rundown on all of the great activities that are going to be happening at this event coming up on Saturday, October 7th. Carol, great to talk to you again. Thanks for joining us on the line.
Oh, thank you, John, for the opportunity. We're very excited to talk about the Wellness Festival. It's our first annual one, and we're hosting it along with Cigna. So that's an exciting partnership.
Yes.
The event is free and open to all individuals with physical disabilities and their families. We are taking a holistic approach to this Wellness Festival. There'll be, you know, complimentary healthy snacks, infused water stations, workshops to help people prepare healthy eating on a budget. We're very excited about the art therapy seminar.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a hands-on project.
People will leave.
We know firsthand, because we have several residents here on campus who are very artistic and have used art in their lives. And it's really been very meaningful.
So some people will arrive empty-handed and leave with something of their own or someone else's creation.
Creative and beautiful, absolutely.
Great.
We are having adaptive sports activities, and that's going to be provided by Gaylord Sports Association and Chapter 126. They've been generous enough to provide games and people to help us facilitate that. We're going to be having free health screenings, which is going to be done by the interim health care. There'll be motivational speakers. There'll be plenty of free prizes and more exciting things. And we also are happy to have Connecticut Health Foundation as a sponsor of the event.
And it's all happening at New Horizons Village, so people who just heard Bob talking about it will get to actually get the full immersion experience.
Absolutely, and we're always happy to have visitors here at New Horizons Village. We really believe that to come and visit us, to get to know us, is to love us. So we're very happy if anyone comes to the event and would like to talk to us about some further, you know, communications
Sure.
or visits. We'll accommodate that as well.
Excellent. Well, once again, it's really important to stress that this is not just for individuals with physical disabilities. This isn't an open house for New Horizons Village, per se. Individuals with disabilities or their family members can come out to this event. It's absolutely free. There's no obligation, and you get access to all of those great resources and information, motivational speakers, snacks, everything that Carol Fitzgerald had reminded us about for this event. We'll give you some more information about it. And Carol, before we meet Marissa, you would prefer people to register in advance for this?
Yes, pre-registration is preferred. You can go on our website at nhvillage.org/news, and there is a way that you can electronically register for the event. If that is not possible, we certainly will accept walk-ins.
Sure. And if folks want more information, they could also give you a call, 860-673-8893.
Perfect. That's it.
And for anybody who wants to just, who may be listening, who can't get out to the event on October 7th, obviously, this is their first annual. They're planning on doing it again on a regular basis. But perhaps you want to learn more about what New Horizons has to offer, whether it's there in Northern Connecticut or in Middlebury. nhvillage.org is their nice, simple website handle to go to.
We have a beautiful new website, and we'd love people to visit it.
Excellent. Carol Fitzgerald, CFO for New Horizons, thank you so much for your piece of the information on this great event this morning. But let's bring our special guest on the line, if you wouldn't mind, Carol, handing over to Marissa McDougall. Marissa McDougall is a resident at New Horizons Village, and I think she's on the line with us. Hey, Marissa.
Hi.
Hi. Great to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well, sir.
So it's John.
That's
okay. Marissa, I get nervous when people call me sir, because that's what the police call me.
Oh, dear.
When they come to my window.
Oh, boy.
So it's McDougall, right?
Yes, sir.
So tell me about your disability.
I suffer from the disability known as spastic cerebral palsy.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically affects the lower half of my body, my legs.
Okay. So tell me about as you were growing up and before you came to New Horizons Village, the kind of challenges that you were facing, because you know, I think a lot of people, they see the handicap spots and they see all the ADA accommodations in the kind of high profile public locations where they go. But I have to imagine that, like, living at home or in a personal space may not always offer all of those accommodations and assistive devices and programs that could help make your life easier.
That is so true.
Tell me about how you got along before New Horizons.
Prior to my moving to New Horizons, which I've been here as a resident since December 2nd, 2008, I lived in an apartment with my mom and my cat, Salem. And it was accessible as best it could be.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the challenges I face with my disability are basically challenges with walking, which the average person may not think is a challenge because they walk every day.
Sure.
But I have issues with walking and balance. And I'm also partially blind in one eye. So being able to see things as far as distances and other things can be difficult at times.
Okay. So then the opportunity to come to New Horizons came to you in 2008. Was this a big turnaround for you?
Well, I'd actually heard about the village prior to my move-in date.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually aware of it in the spring of 1999 when I pursued the first part of my undergrad degree at Tungsis Community College, because some of our residents do go to Tungsis Community College to pursue their education.
Okay.
So through one of through several people who are now friends, I learned about the village.
Super. And how has becoming a resident at New Horizons Village expanded your horizons and opportunities? Not to be cliche, but it sounds like you have been able to enjoy a great deal more independence and mobility because you're in that environment.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's given me, through use of our transportation services, it's given me a chance to basically be the captain of my own ship, which basically means I'm able to go out into the community, go to Walmart, go shopping. I was also able to pursue the second half of my undergraduate degree at the University of Hartford from 2011 until May 15th, 2016, when I graduated with a BA in communications focusing on media and journalism.
Fantastic. Well, as a fellow journalist, congratulations on that.
And, thank you.
Really great to meet you. And
nice to meet you as well.
Folks who are listening will, I imagine, get to see you or meet you when they come out to the event on Saturday, October 7th. Are you excited to
yes,
be part
I am.
Of that? Oh, good, good. Well, we're going to say farewell to you, Marissa, for now, and wish you well. And we're going to pick up with some folks from Gaylord Sports Association who are going to be hosting those accessible sports activities. And then we'll give them a final reminder about coming out to this event. So great to meet you, and thanks for
nice
being part of the show.
Well.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're wrapping up our four fur here on Sunday morning with our final guest of this segment. Katie Jolie is with us. She's the Gaylord Sports Association program manager. And, of course, the Gaylord Sports Association, as we heard, which is going to be part of this event coming up on Saturday, October 7th. This wellness festival at the New Horizons Village. So, Katie, thanks for joining us on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, first, quickly, we've had Gaylord on the program a number of times with some of your great and innovative programs. This is my first time getting exposed to this sports association. Tell us a little bit about that and how you got involved.
Yeah, absolutely. So, the sports association is Gaylord Hospital's adaptive sports program. And basically what that means is we offer 15 different sports throughout the year, and all of our sports are for people and individuals who have had some type of physical disability or visual impairment, and our sports are all specially designed with special equipment, instructors who are trained to teach these sports, and we've got everything from recreational sports, golf, kayaking, to competitive high-level sports like sled hockey or wheelchair rugby, wheelchair tennis. So we've got lots of different activities out there, and you know, what we're really trying to do is to show people that no matter what happens in your life, some things we don't have control of, when you come into an injury or illness, you can still get back out there and do the activities that you love to do.
And that wheelchair rugby, man, that sounds pretty tough.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of our, I guess you would say, rough and tumble sports, and it's actually one of the only wheelchair sports where you are allowed to have contact. So there is contact with wheelchairs, and the chairs are hitting each other, and it's a pretty fast-paced game. Super fun.
So tell us a little bit about the kind of work that you have to do to get an individual, say, who has had full command of their sight or their physical facilities, who tragically may become injured and either completely or partially lose their sight or perhaps completely lose their mobility. What is, you know, for the sake of the, you know, few minutes that we have here on a Sunday morning, and the fact that not a lot of folks out there are specialists like you, can you explain a little bit about how you bring someone from being fully functional, if you were, to being almost completely immobile, back to the point where they can actually participate in some sort of competitive or sports activity?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one unique thing about our program, because we are based at Gaylord Hospital, we're able to introduce adaptive sports even if someone's here as an inpatient at Gaylord. And basically, you know, someone who's gone through a serious situation like you're describing will probably be involved with a number of different rehab programs. They may be going through physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and also therapeutic recreation, which is my background. And therapeutic recreation uses recreation as a form of therapy with different interventions to help people meet their goals. And adaptive sports kind of follows that suit as well. So once someone's ready to start becoming more active again, what we'll do in the Sports Association is meet with that person, find out where they're at as far as their recovery and their rehab, and we'll talk about what their goals are, because everybody has certain goals, certain things you want to get back to, and we'll also, you know, educate on what's out there. I mean, basically, everything can be modified. And, you know, our motto is think possible. We're always focusing on the ability, not the disability.
Sure.
So we look at what you can do, not what you can't do, and we go from there. So if you're interested in whether it's rock climbing or kayaking or golf, you know, we figure out what you can do and how we can make that possible. And that may be with different types of techniques. It may be a modification. It may be a specialty piece of adaptive equipment. Maybe it's a hand cycle or recumbent cycle. So it's really very individualized, depending on what each person needs.
But that being said, folks who come under the care of the team at the Gaylord Sports Association and folks like you, it's the very first time and hopefully the only time they'll have to be in this situation. However, you guys see it all the time. So are you in a good position to be able to counsel these people, or at least even know in your own team's minds how much or how long it would take for an individual in a certain condition to kind of make that jump to the point, even if they may not believe they can or they're unwilling to do it? You know, in other words, can somebody who loses complete control of their lower extremities, you know that they could achieve a certain degree of mobility or activity within a certain amount of time in almost a uniform standard?
You know, it's hard to say. There's not really a standard, and really everyone's situation is so different. We've had patients here at Gaylord who will start getting back into activities like this within, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of their injury. And then we've got some people who, you know, they're a year after their injury, and they're just starting to gain the confidence and the mobility and get back into things. So it really,
sure,
really depends. I think, you know, the best situation is really getting as active and involved as soon as you can.
Right.
That really is the key, because once people are done with rehab and go home, you know, using a program like ours to jumpstart and to continue your rehab is really important. It can help you gain confidence, independence. You can get stronger. You can meet other people who are maybe in your same situation, mm-hmm, and learn from them as well. So I wouldn't say there's a set period of time, but I would encourage anyone, you know, to get involved as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there's certain contraindications where someone, you know, couldn't get involved in an activity they wanted to right away because of medical precautions, you know, we can find something else. And then when they're ready, we can work on that goal.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of it has to do with what's going on from the neck up, if you will.
Sure,
yeah,
absolutely.
Super.
That's true, too. You know, sometimes it's all in how the person processes through their own recovery and when they're, you know, more mentally ready to think about maybe doing an activity in a different way than they used to.
Excellent. Well, Katie, it was great to meet you, and we thank you for this great information, as well as you and your team's willingness to participate in this really interesting first-of-its-kind event, this wellness festival for individuals with physical disabilities and their families. Folks, don't forget, it's all free. Whether you who may be listening are involved directly or you have a loved one, the folks at New Horizons Village welcome you to come out on Saturday, October 7th between 11 to 2 at their Unionville location. You can go to nhvillage.org/news for more information. There'll be complimentary snacks, infused water, healthy eating on a budget, workshops, art therapy seminars, and hands-on art projects, as well as an opportunity to meet with and interact with the folks from the Gaylord Sports Association and Katie. Free health screenings, motivational speakers, prizes, and more. It's all for free. It's all at New Horizons Village, and we hope folks will come out. Katie, thank you for your great information, as well as our guests Bob Marr, Carol Fitzgerald, and Marissa Dougal, who will all be at the event. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.